Disclosures. The information provided to you today is for educational purposes only. It is not intended to be specific recommendations or advice. Please consult with a qualified professional before acting on any of this material. Investing involves risk. Depending on the types of investments, there may be varying degrees of risk. Investors should be prepared to bear loss, including total loss of principal. 529 College Savings Plan Disclosures. Investors should carefully consider investment objectives, risk, charges, and expenses. This information and other important information are contained in the fund prospectuses, summary prospectuses, and the 529 product program description. These documents can be obtained from a financial professional or directly from the plan's website. Please read them carefully before investing. Depending on your state of residence, there may be an in-state plan that offers tax and other benefits, which may include financial aid, scholarship funds, and protection from creditors. Before investing in any state's 529 plan, investors should consult a tax professional. If withdrawals from 529 plans are used for purposes other than qualified education, the withdrawal could be subject to a 10% federal tax penalty, state penalties, federal income tax, and state income tax. Brad Baldridge's disclosures. Brad Baldridge is a registered representative with Cambridge Investment Research. Securities are offered through Cambridge Investment Research, Incorporated, a broker-dealer, and member of FINRA and SIPC. Brad Baldridge is also an investment advisor representative with Cambridge Investment Research Advisors, a registered investment advisor. Baldridge Wealth Management and Baldridge College Solutions are affiliated. Cambridge and the Baldridge Companies are not affiliated. The registered branch location is at 10521 West Layton Avenue, Suite 200, Greenfield, Wisconsin, 53228. There's a top line price, and then you get all your discounts. Need-based aid, merit aid, federal financial aid, state financial aid, those types of things. It brings you to a net cost. And again, for the upper middle income and up, it's not going to be zero most of the time. It's going to be $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, whatever that number is. Well, then how do you pay that efficiently?
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. I'm your host, Tate Duryea, here with my buddy, Ryan Gibson. What's happening, my brother?
Tate, not too much. Excited. Sold a bunch of properties last week. Bought a bunch of properties last week. Yeah, it was really cool. We actually had like four of our self storage syndications sell last week, and our investors locked in a nice profit. So super excited about that. And then we bought a bunch of properties, which you're participating in, growth fund. And we just closed on those. And so super excited about that. And just incredible. A ton of activity coming up. So I've been burning it at both ends, to be honest. I've been working really hard.
I kind of have too. I traded into a three-day trip last week so that I could fly to Colorado Springs on my layover day. And there was no direct out of LA. So I had to go through Vegas on the way up, through Phoenix on the way back. Spent 6 hours on the ground there looking at 1,335 acres that we're buying in Canyon City, Colorado.
Nice.
Very excited about that deal. We've got some preliminary information coming out. Well, this is probably airing in about a month from now. Yeah. So the deal will be closing right around now.
Yeah.
So if you haven't checked it out yet, go check it out. It's an amazing deal. Yeah. Very, very excited.
Yep.
But anyway, yeah, just been flying and working on all these exciting opportunities, especially with that one with you, the growth fund. So, but anyway, what are we talking about today with Brad Baldridge?
We're talking about planning for college. How do you pay for it? How do you know what resources you have available? If you are a pilot, and maybe you're in your probably 50s or 40s even, or maybe you're in your 30s and you're just thinking about planning for college, what kind of vehicles are out there? How do you save for college? If you are a high income earner and don't qualify for a lot of scholarships or aid, how do you best position yourself to pay the littlest amount possible, or when you pay, or how you pay, or payment plans, things like that? Brad is our guy who's coming on the show, who's got a blog and does this professionally for a living. And we're really excited to just introduce you at a minimum to somebody who can represent you and kind of help you through a lot of these financial challenges, especially just one more quick tangent. I mean, college is increasing in cost, and now the cost to borrow to go to college is also way up. So it's like a silent yep. cost. So I think this is becoming more and more critical for those that are choosing to help their children go to college, or just even if you're a aspiring college student listening to this.
Yeah, or maybe you're in your 20s and you had a crazy layover in Ypsilanti, but that's neither here nor there. Let's get into the show. Brad, thank you so much for coming on the show. We appreciate having you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So college planning, how did you get into this? Let's start with a little bit of background on you. And
yeah, so kind of a long and interesting path, but I started in rental real estate and that type of thing out of college. And then I switched careers to financial planning, and I did a lot of presentations and financial education while in that area, and then got involved in college planning and realized that it was kind of a unique territory where there's not a lot of competition, and it was a problem. And when I started 15 years ago, 18 years ago, it was kind of stressful, and it's only gotten worse since then, because the prices keep going up and they keep adding programs and doing things differently. And now it's this big convoluted mess of aid and different areas where you could possibly, you know, save money on college, but you got to understand all the different programs and how it all fits together and which ones to pursue. And it's kind of like taxes and other things where every time they add something to try and help a group of people, it just gets a little more complicated.
Very interesting.
How are interest rates impacting college loans right now?
Oh, they're going up. So the federal loans are tied to the 10-year treasury. So every summer they look at the 10-year treasury number and then they add 2% for one loan and a little more for the next loan. And that's the interest rate. So wherever the 10-year treasury is at the May auction, that determines the rate. So obviously the May treasuries have gone up quite a bit over the last couple of years. So now student loans, they're still a good deal. A student right now can borrow at about 5% and a parent at about 8.5%. And that's the federal program. And then you've got the private loans. And the private loans are more market driven, but because their biggest competition is the federal government, that's who they're competing with. So people with fantastic credit and good ability to repay loans can probably beat the federal system a little. People that can't, don't have all those things that, you pay a little more. But for many, many families, defaulting to the federal system is kind of a safe, it may not be the absolute best interest rate you'll ever get, but it's, the terms and conditions are pretty clear. And, the repayment plans that we hear about and all the stuff going on in the news, it all applies to the federal loans, and none of that applies to the private loans. So, some of the forgivenesses and stuff like that just aren't available to the private sector.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Well, if you're listening to this, you're an airline pilot. So the good news is you're making good money, and it's not going to be as stressful as, some other careers, but it's still a massive amount of outlay. So what should, Brad, we spoke briefly before the show and you talked about early stage versus late stage college planning. What's the difference there? What does that mean?
Right. So early stage is, hey, we're pregnant, or we've got a 2-year-old or a 7-year-old, all the way up through middle school, where college is in the future. You don't have a lot of details, but perhaps we should prepare. And, for most people, they think of, we should set up the savings plans of some sort. And then late stage is kind of high school, freshman, sophomore, where you're now switching from, well, we can do more than save. We can actually start visiting colleges. We need to figure out if we're going to qualify for need-based aid or merit aid. Is it public or private a good fit? Big or small? What's the academic profile of our student compared to, the schools that we think we want our students to attend? What's the family budget? Can we afford to spend $85,000 to send our kid to Harvard or not? And then, of course, can our kid get into Harvard? That's a completely different challenge. And so there's a lot of work to be done at the late stage, even if you did a fantastic job early stage.
Ryan, you've got two young kids. I know you're dying to jump in here.
Well, we've set up a 529 plan, and mm-hmm. yeah, Well, we probably haven't done as much as we should have. I have a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old son. What does somebody in my shoes need to be doing right now? For those that plan to want to have their kids' college tuition sort of set and paid for or taken care of, other than enrolling them like you know, ice skating or some kind of sport to make sure they get a scholarship. No, I'm just joking.
Yeah, right. Well, and right. I mean, your kids need to be what, you know, do the best they can do, right? And rise to their potential, whatever that means. But there's like, there's a really big challenge of, you know, the average public school right now is about 27,000. The average private school is about 57,000. And there's some variability, of course. So the, you know, publics are between 20 and 35 probably, and privates between 40, 45 and 85 right now, or 89 or soon to be 90. I'm pretty sure a college is going to break 90 in the next year or two. But that's list price. So that's the total cost, tuition, room and board, books, fees, beer and pizza. It's the whole cost of a typical college student for 1 year. Now, most people don't pay list price. It's kind of like way back when we used to buy cars and they had the invoice price or whatever, and you could go look that up and use that as a bargaining chip. And obviously, it's, a lot has changed as far as how pricing works, but it's the same with colleges, except that the discounts could be substantial, like 50% off, or, you know, I can go to this school, it lists at $75,000, but I'm going to get a $40,000 scholarship. So it's really $35,000. So a lot of people rolling into it are saying things like, well, we can't afford to go to that school. It's a $75,000 a year school. We're going to go to the local state school. Well, if you're in an expensive state, like Illinois, let's say, you could go to their flagship University of Illinois in Champaign for about $32,000-$35,000. And that example I just mentioned, $75,000 minus a $40,000 scholarship is also $35,000. So there's not a lot of difference. And in a lot of states and in a lot of situations, that's not an accident, right? Colleges know who the competition is. And if you have a strong kid that can get into your flagship school in your state, that a lot of times that would be a strongly rated school. I mean, that'd be the University of Wisconsin, University of Illinois, the UC schools, you know, UVA. There's lots of really strong public schools. Not every state has this a really strong school, but many do. And if your student can get accepted to those, they know that they're, you know, they carry some weight. They actually, their education is considered high quality. And it's also very selective. So a lot of times in the states where those schools exist, it's only the top 10 or 15 or 20% that are going to get accepted. But that's legitimate competition. And they know what the price is. And so a lot of times the private schools might say, well, for kids that can go there, you know, for us to say we're 75 versus 30, we're not going to win that very often. But we could be 35 or 38 or 32 or 27, depending on the state and the student. And now we're in the game. You know, many parents, you know, just like when we buy a car, we don't look for the absolute lowest cost. We look for the best value of whatever it is we're looking for. So like in my family, my wife absolutely insists it must have heated seats. So I don't look for the cheapest car. I look for the lowest cost car with heated seats, because in the end, if it doesn't have heated seats, it doesn't matter what it costs, I can't buy it. So it's kind of the same around college, right? What are your minimum requirements as far as academics, as you know, et cetera, reputation, whatever else is important to you. And then, you know, so a lot of families are saying, well, we're willing to spend 45 or 50 if we can, if it's worth it, if, you know, if we see something that's valuable. And then I get that question all the time. Well, is this college worth it? It's like, well, that's like saying, is that car worth it? You know, that $100,000 right. sedan over there, you know, somebody just drove past in it. They thought it was worth it. They went and bought it. So, but many other people would look at that and say, who would spend $100,000 on a basic car just to get you from, you know, just to take the kids to soccer or whatever, right? So there's a little bit of opinion.
So what about a 529 plan? Like, can you break that down for maybe some of the new parents out there that have, you know, they've heard of it, they don't really know how it works. What is it? And let's discuss some strategies around that.
Okay, yeah. So the 529 plan is a plan designed to save for college. So it's just about every state sponsors a plan. It needs to be sponsored by a state. And in your state, you may get some additional benefits mostly in states where you pay taxes. So Florida and Texas, where you don't pay a lot of taxes, there's not as many benefits. Other states, there's quite a lot of benefits in a state tax.
I wasn't aware that it was a state. I thought it was a federal, like a 401k.
Yeah, well, it is under federal code. That's how what created it. So it's a Section 529. But in order to be created, it's a combination of some sort of state has to sponsor it for some reason. So like I said, there's one associated with just about every state and multiples in some states. And then there's two types technically as well. There's the one where it's a savings plan where you put money in and you invest it similar to a 401k where they have a menu of investment options and you pick your choices. You invest and it grows for college. There's also what's called the prepaid tuition plans. But technically, those are also 529 plans. I don't recommend those nearly as often because there's definitely some buyer beware in those plans because some of the states have been struggling. And, you know, it turns out that, you know, in some instances I've seen it where you'd have been much better off to not even had gone down the road because you know, over 10 years, you put in $55,000 and then when it's all done, you take out $57,000 and you go, well, wait a minute. That doesn't seem to be worth it. I would have done much better had I just invested it in a bank account. So there's some cautions that on the prepaid plans. But the normal plans, a lot of people use them. They're not the only game in town. There's also education savings accounts. And you can pair that with more exotic strategies, potentially, things like Roth IRAs or just taxable investments or individual stocks or, again, different strategies. If the family owns a business and some of those types of things, there's strategies as well. So, but that's the basics. Now, why a 529 versus a bank account or just buying a mutual fund? Mostly it's taxes. So it grows tax deferred. And if you spend it on a qualified college expense, you take it out tax free. So you put in, you know, $20,000 when they're three and it grows to $50,000 by the time they get to college. You can take all that money out tax free as long as you spend it on college. And of course, spending $50,000 on college these days is not hard. And
right. So it's essentially like a Roth.
Correct.
Right? Because you're putting in after tax money, you don't get any sort of a tax benefit for putting money into it, but it grows tax free. So it's like a Roth college savings plan.
And that's where the states come in. So you might get a small state benefit for putting it in, but not a federal benefit typically.
I see.
Now, and that's the good side. Let's talk about the downside. The downside is if you take the money out and don't spend it on college, then you have to pay taxes and penalties. Again, similar to retirement plans, right? It's good for its purpose. If you don't use it for its intended purpose, you end up paying penalties and that type of thing. Now, there's a couple ways around the penalties and or the taxes because you could now use it for college expenses, but you can, in the near future, you'll be able to shift it over to a Roth IRA for the beneficiary. You can use it to pay off some student loans, and then you can change the beneficiaries. Okay. So for many families, you might have multiple accounts for each of the kids, and then you can shift from kid to kid, and then even to the next generation.
So if one's a shining star, you can say, okay, well, this one's not going to college anymore. And so you can use both 529 plans for one.
Exactly. Or the shining star is the one that got so much aid that they don't need it. And
there we go.
You shift it, to the other students or whatever it might be, or one ends up going to grad school so there's enough flexibility that oftentimes taking advantage of the tax benefits. And again, as you mentioned, the higher income crowd, they take away a lot of the other benefits that, deductibility of student loan interest and all these other things are gone, but 529 is still, and because you're in higher tax brackets, avoiding taxes is now a much better proposition, more money in your pocket.
What about going to flight school? Because, these days, all the major airlines have dropped their 4-year college degree requirements, which is wild. That's something that I never thought I would see in my lifetime, but the pilot shortage is so bad now that they've dropped the 4-year degree. And so what if you had a 529 savings plan and your kid is a few years away from graduating and they say, I'm going to skip college. I'm going to go to flight school. Would that qualify? Do trade schools or flight school qualify?
Generally, yes, but you'd have to verify. So any school that's on the federal system, which is, again, there's a few truck driving schools and beauty schools and perhaps flight schools. I don't know them specifically. But a vast majority of them are probably on the federal system, again, because of it's to the institution's benefit, because then they can accept grants and they can accept loans, and it just makes it easier for their constituents to pay the bills. So most, I think, are shifting that way if they haven't gone there already, although I don't have any specifics, but you certainly can talk to any school. And anything that's related to a college or tech college or an arm of a tech college is probably under that umbrella. There might be a few just general instructors flying off at a local airport where you're just getting your basic pilot's license or VFR, that kind of stuff, probably not. But if it's associated with some sort of education program, yes.
Who doesn't, what career doesn't need to go to college today that needed to go to college 2 years ago?
Oh, they're eliminating college requirements in a lot of places for the same with the pilot shortage. There's just a general worker shortage. So a lot of places are now are saying, you know, we used to require a degree. And why did they do that? Well, because they could do it and it wasn't considered discrimination. And it upped the quality of their applicant and it was pretty easy. And they had enough applicants so that it didn't hurt them. Now they're realizing, well, we need to sift through all applicants. We can't just automatically cut a big chunk of potential applicants. And there's a lot of alternatives. You know, in the adult education, there's already been a big shift from you have to have a college degree to you have to have an education. College and education are two different ideas, right? Because there's a lot of college graduates that we all know that don't seem like they got much of an education, right? But they got the piece of paper. And that's almost by design, because in the past, it was required, right? If you want to get from this job to that job, you got to have a four-year degree. So people would say, well, I'm eminently qualified for that position. I already know the position. I just need that stupid piece of paper. Where can I do and where can I go with the least amount of work and the least amount of cost and get that piece of paper so I can get that job? They have no intention of learning anything. If they don't learn anything, they don't care. They just need the piece of paper. And then on the other side of that, right, there's all kinds of ways that you could learn what you learn in college. You could read the college textbook and go through calculus all on your own and learn calculus. You don't have to go to college to learn calculus. And that was the way many people did it long ago, of course. But now there's that balancing act of, well, if I could go pass the bar exam, could I be a lawyer? I mean, I can pass the same test that the people that went to law school did. Shouldn't I be able to be a lawyer? And that's another big can of worms, of course. But
so, I mean, the guy in suits did that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the big challenge, right? Is we want our kids to be successful and happy. And it used to be that college was like that automatic ticket. You know, 20 years ago, when a lot less people went to college, it meant something. Now, because a lot more people are going to college, and they've lowered the requirements in some places to where it's not that hard to get the degree anymore, its value has come down with many employers. And they've just, you know, and again, a lot of people, the solution was, well, we'll just go to the master's then. And
And that's interesting too, because like you're saying, the value has gone down, but the expense has gone up because college has only gotten more expensive from a tuition basis. But now the cost to borrow funds to go to college is double, triple what it was. So that's kind of like a hidden cost that you don't even realize that comes later that you don't realize. And then, you know, they just swatted down the ability to forego paying back your student loans. It doesn't look like that's going through. So it's a really real threat to college. And then you also have, a lot more online education and access to information that you otherwise need to go to college before to get. So it's like you have this rapid declining value and you have this rapidly increasing cost. Mm-hmm. You know, what does the future look like in your opinion? I know you're just helping students.
Exactly. My crystal ball is just as fuzzy as yours. But here's, if you look at adult education as an example, there's all kinds of hybrid online and on campus and hybrid and all kinds of different ways that you can do that, you know, mostly at home, but every other Saturday you go do the lab work on site or whatever. It's just all kinds of different ways to get an education. And then there are certificate programs, right? You can get a Google certificate saying you're qualified in Google Analytics or whatever, Google. And that carries weight with employers. If you can get those certificates done, they'll hire you because there's a correlation to competency and the certificate. So there's all kinds of different paths, especially in adult education. Now, on the flip side, there's a whole lot of parents out there and probably a lot of your listeners who essentially say, when I was young and I went off to XYZ campus for 4 years, that was one of the best times of my life. And mm-hmm. I want my kids to have that experience. And in your example, maybe you're also an airline pilot and I make good money and I can afford to make it happen. Therefore, I will make it happen. Right. And it doesn't really have to do with, well, what's the return on investment? Well, parents aren't asking that question. They're like, go off to college, have a blast, do what I did, grow up. It was a, you know, and I'm one of those parents. I've got kids in college right now. And that certainly was part of it, is I enjoyed my college experience. And I think that's, so there's always going to be that.
I can totally see that.
That side of the residential.
Because it's definitely a, right, a coming of age and a time in your life that, you know, builds a lot of character outside of just what you're learning.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, getting back to the idea of, you know, do you need to go to college? It's like, well, if you want to be an engineer, yes, you're going to have to go to get a degree, right? If you want to be a doctor, you're going to have to go to college, right? But if you want to be in, you know, event management, if that captures you early on, then maybe doing some sort of a trade program or an internship with an event company and where you get to travel and you know, do that sort of stuff would make more sense. So,
right. Absolutely. I can't remember where I stole this from, but it's not my idea. But there's a kind of a question of, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? And then what are the paths to get there? And if college is the only path, well, then your decision's made. But sometimes there's multiple paths to that same destination. And then you can decide, well, maybe college is the easier path or the right path for me, but it's not the only path. I could choose other paths as well. I mean, you mentioned it seems like I want to be an airline pilot is not automatically you got to go to college anymore. But how tough is the other road? And I think military is obviously another path to becoming a pilot. Again, not right for everybody, but for some, it might be the right path as well. So that's, I think, the ongoing challenge.
Absolutely.
Of, you know, and things are changing. So that's when we talk about the young kids, especially, it's like, well, what is, you know, education is slowly, and COVID accelerated, but education is changing it. But there's a little bit of resistance, you know, because of the ivory tower idea, and they've got a lot of political capital, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of money and loans that are coming that, you know, we don't have to worry about prices. We'll just allow them to borrow more money. And that's worked. And finally, now we're kind of at that limit where even well-to-do parents are saying, this is crazy. I don't think I want to do this anymore. There's got to be a limit.
Well, I flew with a guy not too long ago and it was like, oh, my kid got into Syracuse. I'm like, oh, congrats. He's like, no, not congrats. It's like $95,000. So, and he's like, the problem is I make too much as a pilot. I got to foot the bill, you know, and then, oh, but I got to, you know, scholarship call or financial aid call tomorrow. And then he, you know, I flew with him the next day and he said, oh, they're going to give me $5,000 off a year. He's like, it's not really going to do much.
Exactly.
Kind of getting back to like planning and preparing and what should I do now as a, with a 6 and a 3 year old, what is the number one surprise that late stage planners have that you could go back and just, guys, do this one thing, or this is what everybody gets wrong, or everybody is taken aback by this. What would you say that is?
Well, yeah, I don't know that there's one thing, but there's many, yeah, many things that you look back on and say, I could have done that better. I should have done that better. But I think what people need to realize is education is going to be a large line item in your overall family budget. And if you don't put it in there early, it's going to be a really large item in the late stages, or payback loans or whatever it might be. And I think, and because parents value it and they find themselves painted into a corner when, you know, nothing's too good for my little Johnny or Susie. And all of a sudden they say, well, I guess I didn't realize that what I was up against. And now I guess I have to take this big loan. And again, if your income's reasonable, you probably can recover from it, but it might require a year or two more of working than you had thought or something like that. Other times I've seen it where it just completely decimates a family, you know, similar to a sudden illness or anything else that it's like, wow, this really was not planned for. And it really shouldn't have ever happened. And I think that's the, and for a lot of families, it doesn't need to happen because if you pay attention, there's a wide range of costs and a wide range of choices. And if your student falls in love with the expensive one, and you mentioned, you know, I'm Syracuse, it's crazy expensive. They gave me $5,000 off. It's like, well, that same student could apply to a couple other private schools in the New York area, and one of them might have given him $45,000 off, but because of his major or academics or financial situation or whatever it might be. But then you have to say, well, I know Syracuse is your favorite school, but this one over here that's, you know, 95% there in all the aspects is so much less that, you know, that's all I'm willing to spend. And I think that's the tough discussion to have at the end of the process. You know, when you know, again, you take a typical upper middle income family and the kids are whining and complaining that their phone's too slow and that, hey, look at the latest iPhone came out. And then for the next birthday or Christmas, there it is. And then they turn 16 or 17 and they're like, man, you know, dad, if I had a car, well, then you wouldn't have to take me back and forth to practice all the time. I've got my license. And you're like, yeah, that would make my life simpler. So a decent used car shows up and they get to drive it. Well, now they're thinking, well, college is next. You know, I don't know how dad does it. He'll shake the money tree somehow and he'll make it happen. And they don't understand that there's a difference between a $1,000 phone and a $10,000 car and a $200,000 education. To them, that's all big numbers they don't understand. And if you don't spend the time to educate them about it, no one probably will. And that's where we get into that. Well, I love this school. It's like, well, I love Ferraris too, but there's a limit, and whatever that limit might be, and how you know, that's part of the early stage, I think, that you need to work with is if you think any college, any degree, any price is what you're going to be telling your kids 15 years from now, well, then you better start planning now. If you're going to say any at a reasonable, well, that's you excellent. Need to plan, but maybe not save quite as much, but I think that's a challenge with a lot of financial planners too, is they're going to say, well, you want to save for Harvard, it's going to be 90,000. And they calculate it out and say, well, you need to save 2,000 a month. And then people say, oh, okay. And they start doing it. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Will Harvard actually cost that much? Not for a lot of people, because when you factor in the net cost is what we need to be saving towards. And the net cost is a much bigger variable than the
and of course, adjusted for inflation. Right. If it's 18 years out.
Yes. Now, and that's another interesting fact is right there. People have talked about how college has been going up at twice inflation or three times inflation. And it has been in the past. But the last 3 or 4 years since COVID, it's actually been growing slower than inflation. As far as net cost is concerned, it's actually went down a couple of years because the colleges and during the COVID years actually had to provide more scholarships and more aid. Yes, they raised their top line price. They went from, you know, private school went from 72 to 76 that year, but they raised their scholarships on average by 5,000, even though the price only went up by 4,000. So that's what they had to do to fill the seats. So that's what they did.
Who's your typical, who do you help the most? Kind of like explain your kind of avatar client. And what value do you really add to them, and just to kind of make it applicable for the listener?
Right. So my typical client is upper middle income pilots and that type, you know, not the uber wealthy who say, well, I don't really care what it costs. I'll just write a check or whatever. And not the really low income either, where it's like, well, we got a lot of systems in place to help them. It's the people that fall in that donut hole where they say, you know, I don't get a lot of aid, but I'm not so wealthy that writing checks for $75,000 a year is easy.
Right.
And also late stage.
So the Syracuse guy. Yeah,
exactly. The Syracuse guy, right? Where maybe you're trying to make the decision of, well, we can afford the state school probably relatively easily, but should we stretch and go to a Syracuse at 50,000 or Syracuse competition at 35,000 or the local state school at 20,000? And then the reality of it is for a lot of families, well, what is the net price actually going to be? I think one of the big challenges is you don't get all the final numbers till the end of the process. Whereas, you know, if you knew, you know, the Toyota dealer was going to be 50% off, but the Chevy dealer was going to be 10% off, you'd factor that in when you're looking at the cars and you could kind of net them out. But most people don't understand that, what their discount is going to be at a particular school. So that's where we add a lot of value, is understanding how the systems work, the need-based and the merit system specifically for you. So we can start projecting and looking into what colleges may actually cost and, you know, talking about strategies around that. So there's two steps, right? There's a top line price, and then you get all your discounts, need-based aid, merit aid, federal financial aid, state financial aid, those types of things. It brings you to a net cost. And again, for the upper middle income and up, it's not going to be zero most of the time. It's going to be $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, whatever that number is. Well, then how do you pay that efficiently? And so, you know, so if I need $30,000 a year times three kids, you know, where does all that money come from? And how do I get my tax advantages? And how do I negotiate with the schools and et cetera, et cetera? So there's, and if you can find the right schools, it can change the game as well.
So I want to talk, I want to keep an eye on the clock and touch on real estate, business ownership, and divorce before we wrap up. So let's hop into real estate, because one of the best college planning strategies that I think I've ever heard was from Brandon Turner on Bigger Pockets. And he said for each one of his kids, when they were born, somewhere thereabouts, bought a duplex or a triplex or a quad, put it on an 18-year mortgage, and just let it ride. So that by the time his kid was 18 years old, that rental property would be completely paid off. And so he didn't really care about making a ton of cash flow on it. He's like, hey, if it breaks even, great. Say bought it for $400,000, put $100,000 down, and just broke even. And then of course, you know, as time goes on, I'm sure those rents increase. You start cash flowing. And at the end of it, if they don't go to college, well, then they have their first rental property that they can then manage. And if they do, then you could, of course, sell it or refinance it and use that to pay for college. What are your thoughts on that? And what are some other things that people that own real estate or invest a lot in real estate should be thinking about?
I mean, certainly, if you can successfully own and leverage real estate and be profitable, that works almost no matter how you look at it. You don't have to dedicate it to college. You just make good money and save what you need to make, you know, to make college work. If you did the cash flow numbers, it's like you could cash flow and put it in the 529, right? So if you could make it, have high cash flow, that would work too, potentially.
Can you put a real estate into a 529?
No. You could take the profit from the real estate and put it into the 529.
Wasn't sure, like a self-directed IRA?
There is not. Correct. There is no self-directed 529 that I'm aware of.
Isn't it Coverdale or Cloverdale? What's that?
Coverdale allows you, but it's got pretty low limits as far as what you can only put in $2,000 a year. But that one gives you more investment flexibility. I don't think even that one you can get into the exotics, but you can at least go to like a brokerage account and that type of thing.
Yeah.
So, and again, because of the lower limits and the benefits of a 529 in your state, a lot of times that looks better. Not always. But I think the bigger picture is really there's things that everybody has to do around college. Where, you know, you got to do the visits, you got to choose your school, figure out what you want to be when you grow up, need-based aid, merit aid, and that kind of stuff. But then when you own real estate, own a business, have a blended family, have an athlete, have a high-flying student that could go to the elite schools, have an inheritance or something, you know, sudden money of that sort, a divorce, and all those types of things mean that you have to do extra stuff on top of what everybody else is doing. So for real estate and business ownership, there's the opportunities, as an example, to hire the kids into the business. Like,
let's talk about that.
Yeah, my kids, I have some stuff that I've been sharing with school counselors and stuff that has, I've laminated it, sent it to school counselors for years and years. From the time my kids could shove something through a laminator, I paid them well to laminate stuff. And then they pay taxes on it instead of me. And then they put it in their college savings or they spend it on their blue jeans or whatever is appropriate. But again, they pay a lot less taxes than I do. So
let's pull on that thread, because I think that's a super interesting tactic. If you have a side business, hiring your kids to do that work, how young can Ryan put his children to work without it being illegal?
I don't know. Talk to your lawyer. illegal from what regard? I mean, there's child labor laws, and then there's and then there's tax law. Tax law essentially means you have to pay them a fair wage for whatever they do. But I've heard of like babies being occasionally you'll see a commercial, kind of that C rate commercial that comes on after the news of some local plumber or something, and the kids are in the production.
Right.
Theoretically, those kids could have been paid and paid well, right. and that would be their earnings. I don't know if the plumber was doing that on purpose, if he just thought it would play well on TV. I don't know which one. But I have heard of, you know, kids being involved. Their likeness is licensed to be part of the advertising, and they pay all the way through mowing lawns. And again, some businesses are more kid friendly. Obviously, if you've got a business with hazardous machinery and everybody on the floor has to be 18, well, then that's, you know, that's the way it is. But sometimes office right. work or...
Like, how can you determine how much you can pay your kid that's reasonable before the IRS is just going to raise an eyebrow and say, sorry, this doesn't pass the sniff test? Or is there any sort of black and white material in that?
Yeah, I mean, again, reasonable is, that's a moving target, as always, right?
Of course.
And then when they change the rules for reasonable sometimes too. There was a time when it made sense, you know, if you own a business, you could pay yourself a wage and then take out profits as a draw. And if the wages were more expensive tax-wise, you would take more draws. They changed the rules where all of a sudden it became, you know, it flipped on the tax benefit. And then the IRS immediately flipped on how tight they were on which item, right? Because of, again, so that's a challenge. That's a moving target. I don't, you know, we have to work with your tax people on that. But in general, the way to think about it is, what would I pay someone else to do it? You know, if it was somebody else's right. teenager, well, how much would I pay them to do it? And that would be fair. Another way to look at it is, if I had to pay a professional to do it.
Makes sense.
You know, maybe, but my kid could do it almost as well. Like, you know, so when my kids were young, they did laminating and basic stuff. My kids are older now. I've got a couple of college kids that are very technically capable, and they build the computers for my office, as an example. And I pay them $15 or $20 an hour. I don't remember, whatever it is. And I think that's perfectly fine. I mean, could I pay him 40 or 50? Probably, but I don't need to push it that, you know, in my opinion, just paying them well to do. Plus, I don't want to give them a big head and have them say, I'm worth $50 an hour.
Right.
So, you know, and then mowing lawns and, you know, so rentals, like the painting, the advertising, you know, running the Facebook, you know, sometimes it's, you know, they're more capable than we are because they get it.
Right.
And some of the technology and that type of thing. But yeah, so all of that works well. And then you can, the next layer on top of that is what's called a tuition reimbursement plan, which is, you can give, you know, large companies we've heard of in the past, right? If you work for us and you go back to college, we'll help you pay. We'll give you tuition reimbursement. If you get an A, we'll give you 100%. If you get a B, we'll give you 80%, you know, those types of plans. And you can give up to $5,250 tax-free. Well, now, you know, mom's a realtor. She hires her kid to go put up signs and take down signs and do some running and fetching and whatever needs to be done. And she says, all right, well, I'm going to reimburse you. Now, I set up a tuition reimbursement plan. If you get an F or better, I'll reimburse you. Can she do that? She can't, but she has to do it for all of her employees. Now, again, a lot of small businesses, it's only family. And then there's rules around attribution where the student might need to be 21 in order for it to be fully effective. If it's your own child and your own dependent, if it's aunts and uncles' business or grandma and grandpa's business, then it works a little easier around some of these rules. So certainly you need to work with your accountant and understand all the ins and outs. But again, another $5,250 that you could transfer from the business to the student tax-free. And then above and beyond that is taxable to the student, which again, a lot of times the student is still a better tax treatment. So when we have high income businesses where we're in terribly high tax brackets, you know, sometimes I see some pretty aggressive things in that realm,
right?
As well. I mean, you're making the students independent once you no longer get benefit of them being your dependent, right? If you don't get, you lose all your dependency benefits for your kids being on your taxes, well, then go have them be on their own taxes. And then you shift income to their taxes on purpose because their tax rates are better and they're independent. So they get their own itemized deductions or standard deduction, et cetera, et cetera. So, and get pretty convoluted. Where it's a great fit, it works really well.
You know, we're gonna finish up this show by talking about how folks can get in touch with you. But before we do that, pilots definitely know their way around divorce. So, what advice would you have for divorced couples that have kids in terms of college planning?
Right. Yeah. So divorce is a where things shift there is, well, who's actually going to be on the financial aid, as an example? Typically, for federal financial aid, it's one parent in a divorce situation. And if that parent is remarried, then the new spouse is included and the other spouse is not included. There's a just recently, there's been some changes. So what used to be called EFC is now called SAI. So expected family contribution has shifted to SAI or student aid index. They've actually changed the way divorce works through the federal process. So where, there, you know, if you have kids in college right now and you're in a divorce situation, actually in any situation, the way things worked last year is not the way they're going to work this year. So even though you were denied last year or you got aid last year, this year could be substantially different because they've changed the rules substantially. It doesn't have a big impact on a lot of people, but if you're divorced or own businesses and some of those things, those are the ones that are likely to be affected substantially to the positive or the negative, just depending on what, you know, what your situation was. But anyway, so, and when it comes to divorce, again, who's going to do it? And then there's these levels of divorce, right? I've had couples coming to me with kids in high school and college already saying we're in the middle of a divorce. How do we, you know, what can we do to make college not, you know, turn out better versus worse? So who should own the 529 when this is all done? Who, you know, who owns the IRAs and who owns the taxable investments and who owns the house? And is there things that you can do that would make college turn out better? And the answer usually is yes. But sometimes it's hard to put that extra layer of complexity in an already tense situation. And then the other thing we see a lot, of course, is when the divorce happened 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. And now it's like, okay, how is this going to play out? We didn't really talk about college when we got divorced. We didn't make any agreements. And even today, a lot of lawyers are saying things like, well, don't put anything in writing around college because then you'll have to do it. So I think that's maybe true advice, but it's also advice that speaks to me like, well, just we're just going to fight about that later. We're not going to talk about it now. We're going to let it go. And then when it comes up later, then we're going to have to go do it all over again to try and figure it out because we didn't come to any sort of understanding around it. So I think if you worked with your attorneys and came up with something that's not binding, but at least, you know, we're each going to pay half or we're going to, you know, to each their ability or because what happens otherwise a lot of times is there's a, and again, when they're cooperating, this doesn't apply nearly as much, but in contentious situations, there's one parent that cares more than the other and they end up having to figure out college because the other one can just say, that's not my problem. And they know they can wash their hands of it because they know the other spouse cares enough that they're going to not let it, let that ball hit the ground. They're going to catch the ball. They're going to do whatever it takes to solve the problem. And they can use that, you know, as a leverage point. And I think that's, you know, that's where it gets, I think, a little frustrating. But a lot of the time in the divorce situation, at least you qualify for more aid. There's opportunities to, you know, hide, shelter more assets because you can shift it to one from one spouse to the other. So you can make lemonade out of the lemons. Now, having said that, I occasionally have a parent say something about, my divorced friend had got, it turned out so fantastic, we should just get divorced. That's how we'll pay for college. It doesn't work out that well. But, you know, the pain and agony of divorce and the cost of divorce far exceeds the benefits you're going to get from aid. But if you're going through the divorce anyway, then obviously you take advantage of it. But it's not such that you'd say, hey, let's on purpose get a divorce just to, and we hear about that occasionally, not just in college, but in, you know, Social Security and nursing home situations where divorce was kind of an exotic strategy that theoretically might work here and there. But when it comes to college, it almost never actually pencils out is looking at the actual numbers.
Well, that's a lot of knowledge, Brad. And I wish I could go back in time and know who you were when my dad and I were figuring out paying for college. Because I know that it was very frustrating. So really appreciate everything that you put out on your blog. Speaking of which, can you kind of give us listeners, you know, what is your blog and how to get in touch with you and connect with you on topics like this?
Yes, right. So my website is tamingthehighcostofcollege.com. And I've got free resources like a financial aid calculator and you can do some preliminary work where you put in academics. It's called the money report, college money report, where you put in the academics and your financial profile, and it'll help you estimate the prices of three schools. That's kind of a preliminary look into it. Cost of college is by state, so both the top line and the net numbers by income for all the colleges in a particular state. So you can look at your state and neighboring states, or what. My podcast and my newsletter are there as well. So I've got about 100 and some episodes of a podcast where I do interviews and talk about college and all the different aspects of visits and testing and all the different experts out there, et cetera. So there's lots of free resources. I also have a paid course. And then if you want to reach out to me directly, obviously I do this for a living as well. And you can either schedule an appointment right on the website for those of you that like to do that kind of thing with the scheduling links, or there's a phone number there. You can just pick up the phone and call our office.
Excellent.
Great. Well, thanks, Brad. Appreciate your time. And I know the listeners will take a lot away from all these different strategies and thoughts, and know that they just have a resource to call and help. So thanks for coming on to the show. And thank you, listeners, for joining us on another episode of Passive Income Pilots. We'll catch you on the next one.
Thanks, Brett.
Take care.